right, we are live. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Thank God for Bitcoin podcast. My name is Jordan Bush. I'm the executive director of TGFB Media, which exists to help Christians understand and use Bitcoin for the glory of God and the good of people everywhere. Today, I have the immense privilege of hosting Eric Sammons on the podcast today. Eric, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me, Jordan. This is exciting.
Yeah, this is, there's just a number of different things that I, different ways that I found your work over the past few months and then just happened to get reached out to, by your, I don't know if it's your publicist or somebody who's helping you, advertise the book that you're, that we're going to speak about at length. So maybe for those who don't know, maybe you can kind of introduce yourself and what you do.
Sure. So, as you mentioned, I wrote the book Moral Money, and basically right now I am the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine, which is a 43-year-old magazine that comes from a Catholic perspective, and it talks about politics, it talks about what's going on in the Catholic Church, about culture, things like that. It's a very conservative Catholic magazine. I've been doing that for about 4 years. For a number of years, though, my background undergrad was actually in systems analysis with a concentration in economics, and I worked as a computer programmer and my own software development company for 15 years. But then I decided to get a master's degree in theology. And since I'm Catholic, I can't be a priest because I'm married. So I was like, okay, well, I did want to put that knowledge to work. So I actually ended up working directly for a bishop as his director of evangelization for 5 years down in Florida. And so that was just a matter of trying to evangelize. In the Catholic world, a lot of times evangelization means trying to evangelize the people in the pews. Kind of a little bit sad, but it's true that sometimes people who are in the pews don't really, I don't want to say they don't know Jesus, but sometimes you kind of feel like that. And so I was trying to help them do that. So I've done a number of things, as you can tell, over the years, but I start off in technology, move to more theology and working for the church. And that's kind of what I'm doing now with Crisis Magazine is trying to help our readers to really understand what's going on in the wider culture, in politics, in the church, and just kind of help them along with that.
Love it. Yeah. And I'm here on your website, ericsammons.com. You can go find it there. You also got your master's degree in theology from Franciscan University of Steubenville. You got your regular degree from Miami University. You've written for a bunch of websites, including 1 Peter 5, Catholic Answers, Crisis Magazine, Antiwar.com, The Federalist, Catholic Vote, and Bitcoin.com. So you've had articles kind of all over the place, ranging a variety of topics. Again, you are one of the few, the proud, the people willing to discuss Bitcoin and theology. So we are friends in that regard. I guess I want to know, first of all, how did you get into Bitcoin? What was your initial level of interest in Bitcoin? And has that, the interest in it changed over time, deepened, lessened? What kind of has that process looked like for you?
Yeah, I had my backstory before I heard about Bitcoin even predates Bitcoin itself, because in the early 2000s, I was working, like I said, as a software developer back then, but I really had a real interest in economics, and I was reading a lot of Austrian economics, Tom Woods, reading him, he's written a lot of good stuff about this, and some others, Peter Schiff, others, and I really came to the conclusion that our fiat money system was immoral. Like, that was like a big deal to me. That was like when I realized, oh my goodness, this is not just like, it's not just bad or whatever. It's actually fundamentally immoral.
Yeah.
And so I thought, okay, gold is moral. And I was like, this is great. I found a moral system, a moral monetary system. The problem though, of course, was Amazon didn't take gold.
Yeah.
Nobody got it. And so I was like, and I kind of felt like in my mind, and this was probably like in the 2000s, maybe early 2010s, I was like, this is too bad that we have a fiat system that's very efficient, very useful, but it's completely immoral. Mm-hmm. And then we have a gold that is very moral, but honestly, in today's world, it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
And so I just was like, I thought maybe we should go back to the gold standard, whatever. And then I was listening in 2013 to a podcast. Tom Woods was substituting for Peter Schiff. Yes, there is irony in this, that it was the Peter Schiff show. And he was interviewing Eric Voorhees, Bitcoin OG.
Yep.
And they were talking about Bitcoin. First, I had heard about it. I can't remember for sure. I might have heard of it, kind of glanced at it. But that's the first time I was like, I listened to the podcast. This was like December, I think, of 2013. And I immediately was like, this is it. And I immediately was like, okay, this is what I'm looking for. I bought some Bitcoin at Coinbase. I set up an account at Coinbase. I was like, I'm a conservative kind of fuddy-duddy. I'm a boring guy. Mount Gox was a little too much for me. I mean, which, yeah, thank God, because 2 months later it went down. So like, I was like, I did not want to give my money, send my money to Mount Gox. And yeah, even then I was like, you know, Magic the Gathering, I don't even know what that is, but it sounds kind of shady. So I'm like, give me Coinbase. It seems that Brian Armstrong seems like a legitimate guy. I'll give my money to them. And so I yeah, bought a little bit of Bitcoin. And I kind of, this is funny, I bought my first Bitcoin a couple days for the infamous HODL post at Bitcoin forums.
No way.
Because he posted his HODL, you know, the drunk, you know, HODL thing.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah,
I saw that live. I remember seeing that come up because no Bitcoin's way, price is going down and everything. So I got some. And I really, though, I didn't fully understand Bitcoin, yeah, at the time.
Sure.
And I really saw it much more as a medium of exchange than a, yep, store of value. And I spent a lot of Bitcoin. I have spent far more Bitcoin than I own today.
Yeah.
I mean, I just because I got a Coinbase, like they had a Coinbase card back then, debit, yep, card that you could, that would spend Bitcoin. I had a couple of those. I would buy, this is my most kind of infamous purchase in my family. My, yep, my daughter was graduating from high school. I think it was 2015. And I wanted to get her a beater car just because she needed something to drive around. So I went and I got like this $2,000 car and I sold 2 Bitcoin to buy it.
Okay.
And so like, and the car broke down in a month and it was just, I got completely scammed basically.
Oh,
and
no.
I got, so like it was 2 Bitcoin for a car that lasted a month.
Oh.
And so and I got really into like 2015, 16, I got into a lot of altcoins because I was definitely on the big block side of the block size war, yeah, at that time. I got very involved with Dash. I'm not sure how many people, yeah, are familiar with, yeah, that one. It's kind of fallen off. But it was the number 3 cryptocurrency for a while behind Bitcoin and Ethereum.
Yep.
I was like very involved in that. I was a masternode owner. I was a trust protector, which is like their official organization. So I was one of the leaders of, sure, of the Dash community. And just over, and I was like, and I love Dash because it was very fast and you could buy coffee with it, you know, the,
sure,
whole thing and,
sure, yeah,
and all that. And so
I remember, I just to interrupt you, I remember Ben Swan, I think, was advertising Dash back in the day.
Yep, I remember working with him. Yeah, exactly. Yep. So, and you know, I was writing for Bitcoin.com at the time for Roger Ver, and you know, very much on that side. And I never though, thank God, I never got rid of all my Bitcoin. I did sell a lot of it for crypto altcoins,
yeah,
you know, Ethereum, Dash, all that stuff. And honestly, I didn't do badly on those, yeah, altcoins or anything like that. But I always kept some Bitcoin because it was kind of like, it's your first love. You can't, yeah, like, it's the whole reason I'm here. I'm not going to get rid of it.
We lost Eric.
I'm back.
So then,
yeah, you know, so 2017, you know, was a good year for everybody who was involved. It was a good year for me and everything. But I kind of waned in my interest between like about 18 and 20, just because the altcoins, I just started realizing there's some problems. I had not yet, yeah, really, you know, re-embraced Bitcoin as a true, what it really was. And then I read, you know, the Bitcoin Standard. Yeah. I can't remember what year that was, maybe 1920, whenever that was. And then I started saying, yeah, oh, things started coming together in my mind a little bit more. Like, oh, I, yeah, wasn't really fully understanding Bitcoin completely. I got the basics, but I understand really what it is. It's real value proposition. And so it all clicked, yeah, in me and I really kind of went back all in Bitcoin, sold most of my, I sold all of them eventually in the next couple of years. So all my altcoins for, yeah, for Bitcoin. And so it really was just a matter of, okay, now I understand. I became a Bitcoin maximalist. I hopefully consider myself not a toxic Bitcoin maximalist, but you never know. I mean, we all are on some level probably. But yeah, so that's kind of how I got here, was understanding, like, it took years. I mean, so 2013 I started, kind of went off the path. I think a lot of Bitcoiners do this. You get started, yeah, then you start seeing the alts. They look a little more sexy. They look a little more interesting.
Sing the siren song.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. You fall for it, you know, and maybe you get wrecked, maybe you don't. But either way, you realize, oh man, what? And the funny thing is, my son, he got involved with me in Bitcoin. He was only like, how old was he? 9, I think, when he first got, you know, I first got him into it. And he went into the altcoins with me as well. And I had to tell him finally, like, dude, we got to get out of this. So he's like, yeah. And so I think he might, you know, he's a young guy. He might still be hoping for a hit on one of them, but he kind of is with, yeah, me on that, though. So it's been kind of fun to do it together with him.
now that dad wrote a book called Moral Money, you know, it's going to be kind of one of those things. Where
he was just home. He just got married a month ago and he was just home. He's out of town and he's like, Dad, I got to get a copy of your book, right? He goes, I get a free one, don't I? I said, dude, you're like an OG. You get a free copy of the book. So he's actually orange pilled a bunch of people when he was at school. He went to Franciscan University as well. And I remember the first time I went to go visit him there, all his friends were coming up to me asking about Bitcoin because he had orange pilled them early on, you know, to get them, and they knew I knew about it. So that was pretty fun.
That's funny. So yeah, we're actually recording the morning that it came out. It was a release that BlackRock announced that they have made more money from their Bitcoin ETF than from their S&P 500.
Wow, I had not heard that. Wow. How about that?
It is absolutely nuts what's going on right now. So where did your, again, I haven't read the book yet, full disclosure. I've heard good things and, you know, would love to read it at some point. I think there's actually a copy en route to me based on talking to you.
I hope so.
But kind of, why don't you kind of give me a background on where, you know, what was the impetus for the book? And then kind of what are some of the sources that you're building on to kind of make your case?
So I actually wrote a self-published book in 2015 called Bitcoin Basics, 101 Questions and Answers. And it basically just was like, okay, this is an intro for Bitcoin. People don't know about it. 2015, of course, nobody knew anything about it. And so I was like, about a year ago, I thought, you know, I really want to update that. The technical information is still correct, but obviously it's 2015. Like I just explained my own journey. And so like, I definitely wanted to change a number of things about it. And so I kind of thought that my wife and I were kind of working on making it a little bit different. And I thought, you know, I don't think this is what I want to do because there's plenty of books out there that explain Bitcoin now. It's not 2015. Literally 2015, the only thing we had was Andreas's book, which is Mastering Bitcoin, which was like real high level. So I was like, I'm trying to make it lower level.
Yeah.
And I was like, what is though? And I kind of came coming back to the fact that the morality of Bitcoin was very important to me, and it's not something that's often talked about in the Bitcoin world. I think it's talked about way more now than it used to be, and I just thought, this is something I really want to... I don't think anybody's written a book on this, that the morality... I mean, there's a book on I have it sitting right over here, on ethics, and I can't remember what that one's called, but the...
Is that the Ethics of Money Production?
No, I'm rereading that now. Okay. It's a Bitcoin book, but anyway... I felt like there's not one that really tackles the idea of Bitcoin being moral money. Here's the thing. I have found a lot of resistance in the Catholic world to Bitcoin. Yeah. And I imagine it's probably true in the broader evangelical and other Christian world about the morality issue. And it comes from a couple different angles, but ultimately a lot of it's misunderstandings, but just that's been probably my biggest pushback from my non-Bitcoin friends who are devoted to their faith. They love Jesus. They're good people and stuff like that. But they immediately kind of associate Bitcoin with drug dealers, with crime, or they just think it's like somehow not fair, and or like, you know, you make all this money and you don't do anything, you know, lots of different. And I was like, okay, I want to tackle this. And I was like, I just want to be bold and say, Bitcoin is the most moral money ever created, because that would get their attention. and I do believe it. I'm not just saying it. And so that's kind of what was the genesis of why I was like, I want to write about this, because I just don't think this is a angle that you see as much. And I think it's needed for the Christian world. And in fact, originally I was going to name it Moral Money, the Catholic Case for Bitcoin. But my publisher, which is actually a Catholic publisher, like, wait a minute, what you're saying in here isn't Catholic. It's not like, natural law. It's like basic morality that we share, even obviously all Christians, but even non-Christians, like, you know, Jews and Muslims, we share this. And so my Catholic publisher actually said, no, drop the Catholic from it. I had some Catholic references in it that were like the Catholic. I was like, they said, no, make it, because really this is not something that is the moral views that you're proposing aren't limited to Catholics. And my audience for Crisis is mostly Catholic. That's why I was thinking of them, but they're like, no, let's make this a little broader, because really it's not just limited. Obviously we share, you know, so much, particularly when it comes to basic morality. We all believe thou shalt not steal. So I think that was, that's kind of how it ended up being just the case for Bitcoin instead of the Catholic case for Bitcoin.
Yeah. Yeah. This, I mean, I've greatly benefited from some Roman Catholic authors on these topics. I mean, your Guido Holzman, who's the author of The Ethics of Money Production, you know, obviously is a Roman Catholic. And again, we were blessed to have him come speak at our conference.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. Oh, wow. I wish I had gone to that.
He's incredible. Yeah. He came in. The timing was crazy because he was going to be in the country anyhow. He teaches at a university in France. It was going to be in the country up in Boston teaching at the American Economic Institute for Research or something like that. And so he was going to be there. And so we just actually, you know, shared the expense of getting him here and was just, I mean, blown away to, you know, four years after we wrote Thank God for Bitcoin, to have him at our conference and talking about the topic that, you know, so impacted us in writing our
book. I'm reading, Ethics of Money Production right now. And it was published in April 2008. So just six months before Bitcoin's
released. Crazy.
And the best part is the line where he's talking about electric money. And he says, I don't think in a free market it will ever spontaneously be a money that's based on bits and bytes. And I just started cracking up with that. I'm like, this is great. He literally wrote that months before Bitcoin was released. And you wonder if Satoshi read that, because, you know, he was very well read in the whole in the literature and everything. And you kind of wonder, because, you know, he was working on it already in April when it came out. And you wonder if he picked that up at some point, either before Bitcoin came out or during, and just kind of chuckled like, well, now we have one. Yeah. You know, so.
Well, I mean, there's so many things, right? I mean, are you familiar with Buckminster Fuller?
I don't think so. No.
So Buckminster Fuller was a futurist, and he talked about how ideal it would be to have a money that was backed by energy. Somebody like, are you familiar with Wendell Berry?
Oh, yeah, very so.
Okay. So Wendell Berry, in his book Home Economics, I have a first edition. I like started trying to accumulate first editions and like and signed ones as well. So like, I have a first edition of his book Home Economics, and in one of the, I think it's chapter 3, he's describing this back and forth letter writing that him and one of his friends, other farmer friends, were doing, and they were discussing the nature of currency and what the ideal currency would be. And Berry's contention is that the ideal currency would be one that was backed by energy. Wow. And that book was written, I think, in 87. And so I just was floored to think about, I'm like, there are so many brilliant people here who are not associated as economists, or not, you know, at least nominally aren't economists, but who are thinking about these things and thinking rightly about them. And so, yeah, it's just fascinating. Okay, so in terms of, you know, some of the, what approaches does your book take? I don't have like a chapter outline.
So what I do is, I understand that most people don't understand money. Nobody knows what money is. They don't know how it works. So I really start off very much like, okay, what is money? I talk about how money comes to be used. And I'm trying to, basically, I'm thinking about the myths out there of like the state production of money, things like that. So I'm talking about how it happens naturally. And what happens is certain goods have certain properties to make them better money than others. And so then I just basically am trying to introduce, and I introduce the properties of money, the seven properties of money I list. But what I do is, and this is something I haven't seen anybody else do this before, maybe they have, but I haven't seen it. I don't just say there's seven properties of money. I say there's two categories of properties. There's the usefulness efficiency category, then there's the moral category. So we have durability, divisibility, portability, fungibility. There's our usefulness. A good money has all four of those things on some level. And then, though, there's the other ones, which is scarcity, verifiability, and independence. And I haven't really seen a lot of people talk about independence, but I kind of feel like independence is one of the most important properties of money, of good money.
Yeah.
But those are moral properties, really. They make a money more or less moral. And so by kind of, I break all that down. What I'm doing is I'm leading the reader on to say, okay, fiat money, it just crushes those four: usefulness, efficiency. Yep. It just is great at that. Gold, it crushes those moral properties. Yep. But if you look at it, gold's not so good on portability. It's not even that great on divisibility. I mean, you know, in modern times it isn't. And then if you look at fiat, it's just completely fails miserably on the moral properties, fiat. So I'm leading them to, okay, guess what? There is now a form of money that crushes all seven of those properties. I even have a chart where I'm kind of listing, and I give them like little rankings, each property. And so it's kind of leading the reader to say, okay, you first have to understand what money is, because I know, and I'm sure you get this all the time, when you talk to somebody about Bitcoin for the first time, you realize they have no idea what money is. And if they have no idea what money is, they're not going to understand Bitcoin. And so that's kind of where I lead them to it. And then I do have a chapter two, just like how Bitcoin works. I go through the technical on a high level. I'm not trying, you know, I'm expecting them, they could go research it more. But I explain what it is. And then one of the biggest chapters I have in the book is, I think it is the biggest chapter, is objections to Bitcoin. And I just list, I don't know how many, is like a dozen or more objections, and I just list it and then I answer it. And I just go through, and I do have another chapter on other cryptocurrencies, because that's, I don't know how many times I'll mention, somebody knows I'm Bitcoin, like, oh, what do you think about Solana? What do you think about that? What do you think?
Yeah.
You know, what do I think about Trump coin or whatever? I'm just like, oh my gosh. So I'm like, I just want to put it out there right at the beginning. And I don't have quite as harsh of a view of other cryptocurrencies. Like, my basic view is that 99.9% of them are just crap. I mean, they're just, you know, either scams or just failures. Yeah. But there are some that might be interesting technical projects. So if you want to judge them like you would a tech stock, I think that's fine.
Yeah.
I have a problem with that. Personally, I think the blockchain is actually not that great of a technical thing for anything other than money.
So that's the thing. Yeah. I talk to people all the time, and it's like one of the ways that you can figure out that somebody doesn't know what they're talking about is if somebody gives you the whole blockchain, not Bitcoin thing. And like, thankfully that is really kind of starting to disappear. Right. And again, I attribute that to Bitcoiners. Like, I think of guys like Jack Mallows. Like, I just had a tweet about this morning. The educational work that has been done by Bitcoiners, whether it's, you know, Jack Mallers on CNBC or Jack Dorsey or Max and Stacey Kai, you know, like those guys, like just to educate people about their own monetary system, much less Bitcoin itself and how it works and why it prioritizes the things that it does, is astounding to me. The level of discourse has been raised so far by Bitcoiners in just the popular discussion. We're talking more about inflation. We're talking about monetary debasement. Like, these are all things that have entered into the national discourse that just were not being discussed with any level of you know, seriousness before
Bitcoin. It is amazing. Honestly, I really credit Saifedean because of his Bitcoin standard. Yep. I feel like that was it was for me personally, but I also feel like that was a threshold. I remember a before that book and after that book as far as the discussion in Bitcoin world.
Yeah.
Because I remember the whole blockchain, not Bitcoin. It was just because Bitcoin had a bad reputation on Wall Street and in the business world. So like, if I say blockchain, not Bitcoin, I sound like I'm really tech savvy, but I'm not like one of those weird libertarian types or anything like that. So I think that's very true. Like, I'm willing to give the benefit of doubt to founders of other cryptocurrencies that they're just not well informed. And so they might be trying to do something. And it's like, okay, God bless you. You can try that. But my own personal, like my own investment is, I'm not going to invest in any of them, but maybe, you know, maybe one of them will work. Maybe somebody will find some usage of cryptocurrency outside of just as money that does something. But I mean, we've seen what's happened. I mean, like Ethereum in terms of Bitcoin is just like, oh my gosh, that's a death spiral. And I got a buddy who still is super Ethereum. He's a good devout Catholic guy, and he's a great guy. I love him, but he is still super into Ethereum. And I just am like, dude, what are you doing?
Yeah. Well, and this is again, I'm totally willing to grant the same, you know, the same thing. It's like, you know, hey, some of these might be interest as technology projects or something, but that none of them require a token. Like, the point of the token is to allow you to have unaccountable wealth.
Yeah.
if you had to go out into the market and raise VC funds, like on the basis of the, you know, people having interest in the product, that's one thing. But what a token allows you to do is just get all of, like, way more money than you'd be able to get under normal constraints with none of the oversight. And so it presents and creates a horrible incentive cycle instead of incentives for the people who are doing it. So one of the ways that we describe it is just basically the idea that, like, the fundamentally though people, you know, founders of these projects that have tokens, their objection to the Federal Reserve is not that it exists, it's that they're not on the Federal Reserve.
Exactly. They're not able to create the money. I mean, the truth is there's a certain beauty with meme coins because they're not trying to fake anybody out. It's a clear cash grab. And like everybody knows it's a cash grab and everybody's just trying to be one of the people who gets some of the cash before the music stops. And so, okay. I mean, I personally think there's a certain level of immorality in that, but like at the same time, at least it's honest. It's out there.
At least it's saying,
I saw so many of those projects back in 17, the ICO craze and all that. And the truth, the reason I'm not quite as anti because my work with Dash, they were legitimate, sincere people who really believe, and I was one of them, who believed Dash was a good technical project that could really change how we do internet commerce and things like that. Now, I look back on, I know we were fundamentally wrong, but there's been being wrong and being a scammer. Like, you know, we were wrong and we found out we were wrong. I mean, I think Dash is like the 300th highest now or something like that. They were like third. So you just find
yourself out. You can be, like there's earnestly wrong, right? So I mean, you could think about them. I mean, here's an example, right? You could think about them like disciples of John the Baptist, right? Like disciples of John the Baptist were following John. You know, you meet who's the guy? In the Book of Acts, he like worships. Or he follows John the Baptist until he kind of.
Was it Simeon? Simon the magician or whatever? No,
not Simon. No, it's not Simon.
Yeah. We're showing our biblical illiteracy here.
It's the guy and his wife.
They're both struck dead. Yeah, right. Oh, I'm forgetting the name.
It's the one where he's like a powerful speaker.
Oh, yeah.
I can't think of what it is. Anyhow, that's going to kill me. It's just the idea of like you can have a certain amount of information that's true. And like what you guys had, like you guys had a real understanding, real desire, but it was a partial understanding. And so that just led you to do certain things and to prioritize certain things. And so, I think you definitely have to have I definitely think it's easy for, again, you can have the same type of thing happen on a theological level as well, right? There are people who hold theological positions innocently, earnestly, because they've been told them by people they trust, and so they're holding them. And so just to absolutely blast them as if they're, you know, the worst heretic who ever lived, that's probably not, warranted and probably isn't the most helpful way to...
You have to learn some humility because that was me, because I remember I hated the Bitcoin. There wasn't a lot of them back then, but the Bitcoin maximalists back then, I hated them all. Yeah. And I just thought they were the worst people. Like in the Black Says War, I thought the small blockers, they were just toxic and the worst people. And it was a humbling experience to finally say, well, they were right, though. I mean, I'm not going to endorse every action that somebody does. You shouldn't be certain ways. But the point is that they were right and I was wrong. And you just, the evidence just starts building up before finally. It took me a long time, but eventually I was like, okay, they were right. I was wrong. I just need to move forward with that.
Yeah. And again, I mean, good on you for having the humility, because again, that it is so hard. And you get people, especially somebody like Roger. I don't know Roger personally, but like I just can imagine it would be so difficult when you have built your reputation, built businesses, based on your firm belief that things are a certain way. And like the reputational hit, the pride hit to have to come back and be willing to say, hey, I was wrong. Again, like that, you'd want to think that, people would still be willing to do it, but the reality is that it's
the personality of Roger that led him to be Bitcoin Jesus early on is the same personality. It's like a Greek tragedy that is leading him where he is now, because early on he had to go up against everybody. The whole world was like, you're crazy, you're an idiot. And he had to say, no, I'm going to stand right here. I am right. You all are wrong. And he was right.
Yeah.
But then
high disagreeableness can be both.
That's right. And then he kept doing it, though. I read Hijacking Bitcoin not that long ago.
Yeah.
And it just was kind of sad because I remember living through it. Like I said, I worked for Bitcoin.com for briefly. And so I was working for Roger and stuff, not directly as a middleman I worked for. But Roger, his Bitcoin was being sent to me to pay me. And I just and just seeing how he basically is taking everything the small blocker set in the worst possible light.
The worst possible
light. And it's like, come on. I know some of them were kind of jerks about things, but like you're acting like every single one was a bad actor who was like working for the CIA and stuff like that. That's not what happened. Yeah. They were sincere people who believe. Maybe there's some people who were infiltrators. I don't know.
Sure.
They were sincere people who believe what they believe, and you're a sincere person who believes what you believe, and you just simply disagree. It's as simple as that. Yeah. And you ended up being, the market has said you were wrong, if nothing else. Yeah. And that's kind of what it was for me, was the market. That really told me, because I didn't want to believe that they were right. And by 2020, I think it was, around there, I was like, the market's telling me something. I've got to listen to it, because Bitcoin keeps going up, and all these other coins are not. Bitcoin Cash is just dying. And it's not like the market's always right in the short term, but in the long term, it does figure things out pretty well.
It's true. Yep. So I guess kind of what has been some of the, I mean, I know it's early days in terms of getting response, but like what has been some of the response to the book so far? And kind of what are there other things that have come out of it where you're like, oh man, I wish I would have addressed that, or I wish I would have.
I feel pretty good about what I address, but it is funny because, you know, when you release a book, you go kind of on the interview circuit. And like I said, my publisher is a Catholic publisher. So they publish, they're the biggest Catholic publisher in America, in fact. And
do you know Matt Pinch?
Oh, yeah, I know Matt.
Are you familiar with Matt?
Oh, yeah.
Matt, I met him at the, we were interacting about the Catholic.
Yeah. I meant to go to that, but I wasn't able to. But like, the point is they're very tuned into the Catholic world. And so all the Catholic radio stations, Catholic podcasts, stuff like that, they reach out to, hey, would you like to interview this guy? And, you know, and so I've gotten literal interviews from, like, I just last week, God bless them, there's this older couple, they're probably in their 60s or something, and they didn't even know what Bitcoin was hardly, but they wanted to interview me.
Yeah.
And so they literally start off like, can you explain Bitcoin to me? And I have no idea what it is. And so there's a real challenge there, of course, because it's like a 20-minute interview. Like, what am I going to say?
Yeah.
And so, like, I found what I try.
You feel like the mosquito in the nudist colony. You're like,
and I'm just like,
where do I start?
Exactly. And so, like, I'm just like, what I've learned to do is I just kind of tease it. I don't actually explain it. I am like, if I tease it, if they're interested, they'll get the book, or they'll go online, whatever. I don't care. You know, they'll find out more. And so that's why I kind of tease it by starting off with the idea of the money you're using is actually deeply immoral. Catholic station, I'll say from a Catholic point of view, it's deeply immoral. You don't hear this because most people don't understand it, but it is. And Bitcoin is a replacement, a way to have a moral form of money. And I almost just stop there, and I just wait for their follow-up questions, because then they say, like, wait a minute, can you actually hold the Bitcoin? Is it physical? All those type of questions. So that's been very interesting. You know, it's kind of like shifting gears on these interviews, because then I come on Tom Wood's show or on your show, it's like, okay, I got an audience that understands money already, but like, I've enjoyed it a lot. My sister, I got her into Bitcoin a couple years ago. She gets mad at me. She goes, why didn't you tell me beforehand? I'm like, Beth, I wrote a book about it in 2015. What are you talking about? I said, well, yeah, but you should have pushed me more. I'm like, oh, come on.
Oh,
and she and her husband, they're a great Christian family and, evangelical Christians, and they're great people. And like, I finally got them to Orange Pilled a couple years ago. And so, but she just listened to my, the Tom Woods one. I told her about that. Okay. And she doesn't listen to anything I do or anything like that, because she's my older sister. Why would she listen to her little brother? She goes, Eric, you actually sound intelligent. Like, that's the best compliment I could get. My older sister said I sound intelligent. So it's been enjoyable. It's a tough cracking into this world of like, I knew, and like, here's the great thing. So the publisher, the head of the Sophia Institute, which is the publisher, he's a Bitcoiner.
Okay.
And so I knew he was. And so I proposed this book to him, and he's got a talent. He knows a book if it's going to hit or not. I've proposed books to him before, and he said, nope, that won't work. And he always knows ahead of time, okay, is this book going to sell or not? And he literally said to me, this one was, I have no idea if this one's going to sell, but I don't care. I think it needs to be out there. And so, like, there we go. And so, like, I feel like it's doing well so far, but this is the most challenging one for me, because the Bitcoin world is got, they don't really look at it always that way. I mean, other than you, there's not many. And in the Catholic world, they're not thinking about Bitcoin. So literally, it's like a book with no audience. It's like, you know, so I'm working hard to try to bring it together to make it. In fact, I was I told the publicist at Sophia, like, she was like, oh, where are some Bitcoin podcasts or you could get on? And I was trying to think of ones. I said, and I listed you first. I was like, okay, this one is a 100% fit. I'm like, these are going to be stretch goals. You know, let's try to get them, because I can kind of, sometimes you can gather from what a host says, like, I think they're probably Christian. Like, they don't say it necessarily, but you're like, I think they might. So I'm, you know, reach out to them. So
yeah,
it's been good. I feel like it's something, it's trying to break into a world that you know, isn't really that tapped yet for Bitcoiners. Yep. And so and the big thing I'm getting back is a lot of, a lot of people who read it are like, I don't even know how to get started. Where do I buy? I mean, what do I do? So I'm thinking about making some videos on that. But another thing is they want to get their church to accept Bitcoin.
Yeah.
I got my parish, years ago to accept it. We have a young pastor, so you know, he was open to it and stuff like that. Cool. Although, yeah, I set it up. I want to change how he set up. I'll just put it that way. But the point is that, like, and so they're asking, like, what can we do? And honestly, it's like, you know, it's just like Wall Street trying to get a company.
Yeah.
You know, there's a reason why when Microsoft proposed it to the shareholders, it was like 98% or whatever said no. It's going to be even higher percentage at most, you know, churches out there. It just, like trying to get people, and then there is real issues. And I'm talking to some people about this, like, okay, what kind of custody are you going to do? Because if it's self-custody, you can't have the pastor owning the keys. You know, you got to have some type of multi-sig type of thing. Is it maybe better just to do a custodial, like with River or something like that, which isn't necessarily ideal, but like River is like set up for that. And so like, there's all these issues that, you know, you really got to, and I don't think there's a clear cut way. I know River has accepted a lot of churches. Like I see Alexander talk about that a lot.
Yeah. We that's who we recommend for especially people who are just getting started, who again, they're like, they recognize that they need Bitcoin and they're really just trying to help their church get started. Like in their case, again, it's kind of like there's what they're asking and then there's like what they really will ask in 6 months once they have a better idea. And so we just recommend people use River to start out with, because again, they get you like the tax help, the hand holding. It's like enough hand holding to get you, you know, down the road to help you if you need it. And then again, River is going to also, they're going to want you to take custody once you're ready. And so there's educational reasons.
Yeah. And for years I recommend Coinbase just because that's what I was used, I was familiar with, but I was getting more and more, I felt more like I needed a shower after going my Coinbase account. Cause it's like a casino. It's like, I just was like getting more and more. And finally I just cut ties with them about a year ago and went all in with River because I like some other companies, not just River, but I like the proof of reserves of River. I like the fact that they are advocating for self-custody. And so like they're real Bitcoiners, in other words. And so like, that's who I've been recommending more and more, because it's just like, that's a real challenge of getting your church to accept Bitcoin donations, because there are real issues involved, real usability issues, because you don't know, the pastor might know nothing about anything. Maybe he knows something, but like you don't want it to be, that's a major scandal waiting to happen if a pastor is the only one who has access to it. You got to have like some type of shared, it depends on the church, if they have a finance committee, whatever they have, elders or whatever, something needs to be so that there's multiple ways in which the Bitcoin can be accessed securely. So yeah, those are the kind of things that I like these conversations coming up, because it's, you know, it's, we weren't talking about that 10 years ago. I know that.
100%. Yeah. The other thing with River, again, it's becoming a River podcast. We're just, you know, shilling River. But Alex Leishman had a tweet, I believe it was a little over a year ago, where it was something to the effect of, diversity is not our strength. We are a company that's built on, like, name three things. And one of the last things it said was, and on Christian values. Wow. And just within the tech sector to invoke Christ in any way.
Oh yeah.
My eyes bugged out of my head. And so I was like, all right, we're going to exclusively recommend.
I just assumed this is one of those guys I assume was Christian based. Yeah. I didn't see that tweet, but I've seen, you know, I've been following him for a while now. And like, I just kind of gathered, okay, he's got but I didn't know that for a fact. Yeah. And I do know some guys who are at River, and they are. So I was kind of like, okay, obviously it's friendly if nothing else. So.
Exactly. And that's, I'm just grateful. We could say a whole bunch more. So, I mean, we do work with them. If you're listening, you can use promo code TGFB. Nice. So river.com/TGFB. And that will help you get onboarded there and help support what we're doing as well. I want to kind of just, I don't know if there's, is there any other thing? Is there, you're like, hey, I've been, I know of somebody who's written books. Like there's things where you're like, oh, I wish they would have asked me about this. Or is there anything that comes to mind where you're like, I've done a few interviews. I haven't gotten to talk about this aspect of it that I think for either from the book or just even just from the, on the topic of Bitcoin and morality more broadly.
One of the things that I think is a real moral question that I hear sometimes is the idea, the struggle a lot of people have, the hurdle that Bitcoin isn't real. Because as Christians, our faith is very incarnational. God became a physical man. We're not like Gnostics who believe that he kind of appeared as man or anything like that. We actually think he became flesh and blood in the womb of the Virgin Mary. He was actually died on the cross. It wasn't just a fake thing. And so reality, you know, this physical world is very important for Christians. We're, you know, that's a lot of the heresies over time deny that. They try to make it look we're just souls that just happen to have a body. No, we're body and soul. That's how God made us. And so we're not like the angels in that way. I mean, we really are. The body isn't like a periphery. And so, and that's all true. We all believe that as Christians, or at least we should. And so then we talk about Bitcoin. There's nothing to hold. There's nothing like gold. There's a beauty in it. And I'm still a gold fan. I never went away from gold. There's a certain beauty in it in that it has this value of like, you know, as money, it has this usefulness and its morality, but it's also, I can hold it. I actually have in my hands gold. And you and I both know we can hold Bitcoin, but we do kind of, for most people, I had to put that in parentheses. We hold Bitcoin. I can't put it in my hands. You know, my book, you know, I kind of was questioning whether or not we should do the whole coin on the cover because I knew the audience might not realize that that's just a metaphor or whatever. But like at the same time, it's like, and so that I think a lot of people struggle with that. And so I do address it in one of the objections in the book about that because I've heard Christians tell me that they're just against Bitcoin for that reason alone because they can't trust it. And so like, I do think that, first of all, the more time it goes on, the less it's going to be true because usually the older you are. I'm kind of an old guy. I'm in my 50s, but like I've been a computer programmer. So like the digital world has been very real to me for a very long time. Yeah. But I think honestly, like one of my tacks I go on this one is simply that, again, think about what money is. Money is simply that lubricant so that you can live in the physical world. So you can buy your house, your physical house, you can buy physical clothes, you can buy food, you can do things like that. Yeah. You need a lubricant to make that happen. So you're not trading your bananas for somebody else's cows or anything like that. And so ultimately, does that lubricant have to be a physical thing if in the world the best way to buy those physical goods is online, digitally? And so really, I that's kind of been my, because I've struggled with answering that for a long time. And so in writing this book, I was thinking, okay, what is it? And it's kind of to say like, there's no intrinsic need for money to be physical. There is a need for us to live in the physical world. I mean, we have, in fact, I'm as somebody who is online a lot, I'm often advocating to myself and to others, go outside, you know, walk on the trails, go out and do, you know, whatever it is you do to get outside. That's very important that we experience God's creation directly and we appreciate it. But money doesn't have to be quote unquote real in the sense that it doesn't have to be physical. And so I think that's one of the things that I know is a hurdle for a lot. They might not even express it like that clearly, but I can just tell their real problem is that they can't hold it. And so they don't really trust it.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the, and again, we encounter this objection a lot as well for a lot of the same reasons. And I think one of the, again, just some like helpful context that I often add that I found to be helpful just in terms of reframing the discussion is because like there's this perception that physical equals better. Or it's more advantageous. And one of the things that we talked about was, we didn't get to address this beforehand, before the call, but I was a missionary and church planter for almost 7 years in Uruguay in South America. And half of our church members were Venezuelan immigrants who had to flee the country on foot in order to try to get to a place where the government hadn't destroyed the money and you know, try to save money and send some home to their families who stayed in country. And so in their case, the tangibility of something like gold or silver or even cash would have actually worked against them because they were both government-sanctioned thieves in the form of soldiers waiting on the borders who knew that people were leaving with their valuables, and then also just run-of-the-mill common thieves who were doing the same thing. And so, you know, the fact that you would had, if somebody would have had a bag of silver or gold, that actually would have worked against them in helping them accomplish the goal that they needed, which was to move and start over. And so I think that just adding some of that more global looking context is something that because of the Christian heart for evangelism and for international missions, I found that something that really appeals to people and that really kind of resonates with their desire. And so if they see this as something that if they see Bitcoin as something that enables the spreading of the gospel or just humanitarian aid to move in ways that other things is limited by other currencies. I found that to be a helpful thing.
Yeah, and I also think, honestly, I think this is more subconscious, but I honestly think people, they think of like intrinsic value and they literally think in their mind's eye of something inside the physical thing. Like they think of it as like, I'm not saying they consciously think that, but I honestly think it's like, okay, this has intrinsic value because I can hold it. It's like inside it's intrinsic value.
Yes.
Well, there's nothing inside Bitcoin and there's nothing, you know, so like it must not have intrinsic value. And of course, there's the whole problem of intrinsic value in the first place. But the point is like when people think of, is this valuable? They think of the physical like aspects of it that makes it valuable. And it's really that's not what money is though, of course. So that I think is one of the biggest hurdles I've seen among Christians. And it comes from a very legitimate view of the world, the importance of the physical. So I don't want to like discount that, but just explain why in this case we're talking about money. It's not the same as what talking about whether or not, you know, we should value God's creation.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that you get people who they kind of react against the idea of the thing that motivates them to bring up the inherent value or intrinsic value is just some of it is just pushing back against the idea of like moral relativism, where like everything is relative. And I'm just like, okay, I agree with you. People have intrinsic value, like people, because they bear God's image, like they have intrinsic value independent of what they do, independent of all these other things. But in terms of things under the sun that don't bear the image of God, like the value of anything is subjective given the circumstances.
I have a footnote in my book where I'm talking about in the book about how basically value is 100% subjective. It's determined by the person. Yeah. And I put a footnote and I say, of course, I'm talking about things you can legitimately buy and sell. People have an intrinsic value of images of God.
Correct.
And because that's why you should not be allowed to buy and sell them. So I it's funny you said that, because I was like, I when I was writing the book, I was saying anything subjective value, I was like, oh, there's going to be at least one Christian reading this. They're going to be like, wait a minute, are you saying like people? I'm like, no, people have intrinsic value. That's the only thing.
We're kindred spirits. We're kindred spirits in that regard, Eric. Okay, so Eric, you know, if you don't have anything else, do you have other thing to talk about? One other thing. So I just happened to be on the internet the other day. I found an article, and I'll just share. Let me see if I can share the thing here. Let's see here. There it is right there. Okay, so I happened to be on the internet, and I came across this article that said Catholics are rapidly losing ground. And then the other day when I was preparing for this, can you see it? There we go. Okay. I was preparing for this interview, and I saw, this article is written by Eric Sammons. And I thought, what are the odds of that? And basically the big kind of takeaway from the article is based on a Pew survey was that for every, let me see if I can find the number. There you go. For every 100 people who joined the Roman Catholic Church, 840 people are leaving. So that, again, that those numbers shocked me. They shocked me in part because I'm someone who probably is as frequently online. Oh no, I lost Eric.
I don't know what's happening. I apologize.
There you are.
Yeah, you
not my article. Oh, you're good. Yeah. How much did
you just pulled up my article and said cattle are losing ground? So
yeah, it's a kind of the big signal or the big takeaway from the article is that basically according to Pew, for every 840 people or for every 100 people who are joining the Catholic Church, there's 840 leaving. I've thought about this issue a lot. I, first of all, was surprised by the article because as somebody who, I wouldn't say terminally online, but someone who's online probably more than the average person, I see voices like Michael Knowles, who I actually had the privilege to go on his show to talk about, thank God for Bitcoin, a few months ago, around a year ago. I see guys like Matt Frad. I see a number of guys who have increasingly large platforms. And so if one were to only judge by, you know, some of these online platforms, you would assume that the, I mean, Roman Catholic Church was growing significantly. You'd also assume based on guys like Jonathan Peugeot, that Orthodoxy would also be growing like crazy. And yet when you actually look at the numbers, despite these one or two outliers, that what's really going on in terms of the large numbers is actually telling a far different story. So I would kind of love to kind of hear your perspective on that article. What motivated you to write it other than the obvious?
It's something I've been studying for years now. Like I said, I was a director of evangelization for 5 years for a diocese, which, you know, what the what a bishop rules in the Catholic Church overseas. And so, like, I very much have been studying these numbers for over a decade now, about 15, 20 years now.
Yeah.
And I've seen that they've all been going the same direction, which is down for a very long time. Since like before really 2000, they started. And what I noticed was, like, in America, it's all religions. It's not just Catholicism, but the one I'm concerned about, because that's, you know, what I am, is Catholicism. And so I saw this piece today. I was like, I want to write about this as well. And I will tell you, I got a lot of pushback in the Catholic world because of what you just said. Like, wait a minute, things are looking good for us. And the truth is, they're right and I'm right in the sense that, okay, we have in the Catholic Church, we've had for a long time a real, what's the word, like weakness at our church level, what we call our parishes, in that there's a lot of not a lot of enthusiasm for the faith. There's like poor education of our young people. And so what happens is, like, your average Catholic parish, when you go to it, it just is not something that's attractive to people. It does not really preach the gospel strongly. It doesn't, like, stand out. It basically, a lot of times, the sermon each week is, okay, go out there and be nice. Well, that's not going to attract anybody. It's like the same problem with mainline Protestantism. It really is the same thing where it started. We didn't go quite as woke as they did, but we did do the same problem of, let's go ahead and conform to the world, not say anything controversial, not push people. And that's still very widespread. It was very, it started in the 70s, really, and 80s. And it's still kind of widespread, particularly with, because, you know, priests were older and things like that. That's the case. And so that's why, think about it, if you're growing up as a Catholic and that's your experience of Catholicism, yes, so you're a young man, once you get out of the house, you have no desire to go back to that. Because why would you? You don't, I mean, I would say as a Catholic, like, the underlying truth is so important and all that, okay, fine. But it doesn't mean it got to them. It doesn't mean they understand it. Because all they heard was, to be Catholic means you be nice. And it's like, well, I can be nice without being Catholic, with all the rules and all the, you know, the obligations. Let me just go ahead and just be nice on my own. So, and it really was this kind of relativism of, you can be Catholic if you want, or you don't have to be. You can be whatever you want. You know, it doesn't matter if you're atheist, as long as you're nice. And so that really kind of crept in. However, I will say, over the past few years, particularly since COVID, it's happened, there has been a real resurgence in the Catholic Church of a lot of voices, a lot of people. And so what's happened is, a lot of the more traditional and conservative parishes, they have grown like crazy. Yeah. Like, my parish is like super traditional. We actually celebrate the Mass in Latin. That's how traditional we are. Mm-hmm. And so we have grown like wildfire in the past 5 years. So it's funny, I'm writing this article about how everybody's leaving the Catholic Church, and at the same time, my own parish is growing like crazy. Yeah. And so I think people sometimes have a hard time accepting both those things, but I think they're both true. And so my personal opinion is, my prediction, I should say, is over the next 10 to 20 years in the Catholic Church, we will see the overall numbers going down, continue to go down.
Yeah.
But what we will see is the fervency, the faithfulness of those who are in the church, the percentage will go up a lot. And I personally think, I don't want anybody to leave. I'm not like trying to claim, I think it's always a sad thing. But ultimately, I feel like that's a base for future evangelization, because now you have your members who are there are committed and they're really serious about it. And this goes from the bishops, the priests, and the people in the pews. That, I think, is a better a better like step toward, you know, towards getting to where we want to be. So I think both are true, but I do think I want to wake up Catholics to this idea that like, if you're online a lot, you might think, oh, Catholic Church is going crazy, growing. But no, there are a lot of people still leaving out the door. And we got to remember that because they're not known. Like when a parish brings, the way we do it in the Catholic Church is when somebody becomes Catholic, they go through a process and in the Easter, they're received into the church. And so we see that every Easter, it's like exciting. Oh, we just had like our parish had like 12 this year. We had like about 20 the year before. And so, and we're not that big of a parish. So it was good number. Get you all excited. And they tell their stories. You're like, oh, this is great. Like we had this one guy, he was an atheist and he became Catholic. And now his sister who's an atheist is coming in next year. And so you get all excited. You didn't see, though, there was no party. There's no like news about the fact that all of a sudden people who had been going just aren't going anymore. Their kid went off to college and he just left the faith. Those are things you don't hear. And so like, I think, and those numbers are a lot greater still. So that's kind of in a nutshell, what I was talking about there was, and the Pew numbers coincide with everything else I've read. Some people were trying to dispute the numbers. They weren't accurate. I'm like, ballpark, at least, it's what I've seen for 15 years. So I don't see a reason to doubt their numbers at this point.
I think another one of the things that I see is, and I just have been astounded because, I mean, you think about what we've heard for a long time is, and it comes from like, there's a healthy seed of truth in it is we want the faith to be accessible to anybody. Right. Okay. And like, that's a good desire. Jesus used agrarian, you know, parables like that were made to be understood. And at the same time, you know, and so a lot of pastors, a lot of churches have gone that route where we're trying to make things very practical, very easy to understand, very short sermons. Yes, very, very, very new person or very like visitor friendly. But then what you also see is you see Joe Rogan, who has 3-hour, 4-hour podcasts, and you see Netflix streaming where you have 8-hour series and you have all these things. And so there's clearly an appetite for people, an appetite and a willingness to engage with very difficult, nuanced content that basically over the course of hours, you know, weeks, whatever. And there's an appetite for it and a willingness and a demand for it. That's there. I feel like more than ever before in some days. And so it's kind of flying in the face of a lot of these, you know, of like one true, again, it's true that like you ought to want to do this for the sake of children and for the sake of new people. But the reality is that people won't always be new. And if you always treat people, if you dumb things down always, then there's not going to be that same sort of intellectual challenge that is demanded within the call to discipleship.
Yeah, and if you look at Jesus too, like he used these parables and everything that anybody can understand. But there were times people went away from him, and he was just like, okay, like he was very challenging. Yeah. And I mean, obviously they ended up killing him for it. And so like, you know, we have to. There's a story that I tell that happened to me years ago. It kind of made it all click in my mind. My daughter was in, she did fast pitch softball and she was very involved in it. She was on like a good team and stuff like that. And we were at a tournament at one point. I saw a sign that was saying how tryouts for this new travel team. And we were never like super crazy into that because I just felt like it took away from our family. I have 7 kids. I can't like be doing that crazy stuff. But the flyer was super intense about like, okay, you got to make a huge commitment. It's going to be all this stuff. You're going to do this. We're going to take the best. And it was like very much like hardcore telling you this is a huge deal. At the same weekend of this tournament, we saw this flyer. We were at this church. It wasn't ours because we were like out of town for this tournament, whatever. And it was a Catholic parish. And we have altar servers, the kids who kind of help out at the altar during the mass. And it was like an ad for, they needed more altar servers. And it was completely like, oh, no experience needed. You won't have to make much commitment. It's super easy, you know. So it was completely downplaying how easy it was. I guarantee, and I know this from checking on, I guarantee I know which one attracted.
Apparently Eric's having a little bit of technical difficulties. We'll see if we can get him back here.
I'm really sorry. It must be a bad connection today or something.
Yeah, I don't know what's wrong. What's the deal? But no worries. So continue. Yeah, you said you knew which one was going to get more.
Yeah, and it was just it's the one that demands more. And I really feel like that's where we dropped the ball, because we're so much trying to be relevant, to be seeker friendly, all whatever term you want to use. And really, Jesus was very demanding, and so we have to be demanding. And you do it in a charitable way. I mean, Jesus was never a jerk, but he was very demanding. And so I just feel like that's something that. And we've seen that, because, like I said, at least in the Catholic Church, the churches, the parishes that are the most demanding are the ones that are the most successful now. And I think that's true also in the Protestant world. The main line, that's what killed them. They're just like, okay, we're going to be like everybody else. We're not going to demand anything. And now nobody wants. I actually grew up Methodist. So I saw that happen before I became Catholic. And so, yeah, it just is. So I think that definitely is part of the equation. And that's why, because especially young people, why would a 20-year-old guy who's deciding what am I going to do with my life be like, okay, I can just like waste my time over here where they just tell me to be nice and they're constantly trying to appease me. Or like you see, I like running and I love watching like ultra running and stuff like that. Those guys, I mean, it's like they're so admirable because they're like, I am going to sacrifice everything to try to achieve this goal. I mean, the Bible talks about this, run the race to win. And so I think the same thing here, where it's like, I really feel like our churches need to be much more forthright of like, it's not easy to be a Christian. It's a hurdle. You're going to have to work at this. There's going to be days you make sacrifice, i.e. take up your cross and follow me. And so, and when you don't do that, I think you lose people.
Yeah. And I think also, I mean, just theologically, I think that, I mean, the scriptures, like it, the scriptures, the more that I mean, you would think I've been interacting with the scriptures basically my entire life, but seriously, since I was probably 17 or 18. And I went to Bible college at age 18. My parents were going to make me go for at least 1 year. But by the time I got around to it, I was thrilled. And so we studied the Bible from, it was a Bible Institute. So it was just the Bible we were studying from, like 7 a.m. to 1 p.m. And I went in thinking, you know what? I know the Bible pretty well. I've been going to church every Sunday my whole life, most Wednesdays as well. And then I get there and I just was absolutely floored by how much of the Bible I was completely into. and so I just think like that's another thing that, I mean, I just think that theologically there's so much depth, there's so much wisdom to speak to all kinds of areas of life that aren't intuitive, and that we just, the average person just doesn't realize are there. I would just, again, this won't be like hostile at all, but like, I would like, I mean, as somebody who's at a church that, you know, teaches in Latin, I mean, that would be something where I'm like, man, if I was at a church where I didn't understand the language, like that would be really challenging for me. So kind of how do you think about the role of the Latin Mass? Again, I know all of the Catholic, Roman Catholic Church don't do
most of
Latin
most
masses,
of them, yeah.
But I would.
Well, the first thing though is we actually don't teach in Latin. The sermon is in English. Okay. The service, the whole mass service, is all in Latin. And really, it's a matter of in the Catholic world. It's a high hurdle to try to explain this quickly, to a mostly Protestant audience. I understand that.
Yeah.
But like, we have a belief in what St. Paul says when he says, "I give to you what has been handed on to me," and that word "handed on" in Greek is really. The Latin term for it would be traditionis, meaning to hand it on the tradition. Obviously, there's bad traditions. Jesus condemned, traditions of men. Yeah. But basically, the idea is we look at the Mass primarily not as a teaching vehicle. We look at it as glorifying and worshiping God. And so what we're saying is we want to do the best thing we possibly can do to glorify God. And so all the different actions we have, like the incense and the bells and the smell, all that stuff, the statues, everything, that is all like we want to glorify God. And Latin is how the Catholics before us have all done this. And so we're going to continue to do this. And like, there's a certain beauty in Latin because there's this precision that it's no longer about the priest who's celebrating. It's no longer about him. He kind of disappears. And what he's doing is he's just simply repeating the prayers of the church to glorify God. So he kind of disappears if it's in English, a lot of times he will want to be a little more spontaneous and it becomes too much about him. So, but to be clear, the sermon, is in English. So the teaching part of it is in English, but that really, it's a whole different way of looking at kind of purpose. Like we're not seeing it as primarily as teaching, much more as glorifying God. And so the Latin isn't, and the truth is, here's the thing. I do not know Latin. Like my wife knows Latin. She actually teaches Latin to our kids and stuff like that. I've never been good at languages. I'm not even that great at English, to be honest. But with Latin, once you start going for enough time, I've been going now to Latin Mass for 15 years. I know exactly what's going on at all times. And I could not speak a word of Latin to you, maybe a couple words, but like, and I know because of like, and that's the other reason why most people, when you go to Mass, it's again, it's kind of like the anti what you just said. We're not, going after visitors. Like, obviously we want visitors to come, but the point is like, we assume when you're there, you've been there. Yeah. And so like, you've grown up with it probably, you know what's going on. And then what happens, like at our parish, if we see somebody new, almost, we have about 500 people at our service. So we can tell often if somebody's new.
Sure.
Somebody's going up to them afterwards or even beforehand, just saying, hey, just, sometimes we have like these missals that there are these little booklets that give the English translation of the Latin, and they'll be fun with it. They don't even know where it is. And usually what we tell them is you just kind of say, don't worry about this time. Just kind of experience it. And then we'll we'll help you out. So we do those things, but
I'm at a higher liturgy, church. So like we do a lot.
So you understand the language I'm speaking.
Motivation.
And
in terms of a lot of the motivation, like recognizing God's, like this, we're not just here as a group to talk with ourselves. Like we're acknowledging like God is here.
Yeah.
Like he's taking part. Like it is interesting though, because I mean, you mentioned the traditions of men. Like that's obviously something that, like, again, I think there's real issues, and yet the overreaction of that can just be, oh, we just get rid of everything. We just decide every individual church or pastor decides what service is going to look like, and there's no regulating principle or something, no regulation of what's going on. I think that's obviously something bad that can happen. At the same time, I'm just thinking of like, it's interesting to me. I would love to know. You're my captive, Rory Capric here. So, but like, if we look at like the goal of like passing down the traditions that were received, like part of the language thing, I get like when, the Great Schism happened, like all this kind of stuff, you start going in Latin, but, or like in probably even before that, but like the interesting thing would be like, I mean, Paul was presumably speaking Greek. So why Latin instead of Greek?
So, so if you look at it, very early on, the church kind of divided, not in a schism way, but just kind of in a cultural way between the Greek East and the Latin West.
Sure.
And so very soon in the West, the liturgies were in Latin because that was the language of the people. And in the East, they were in Greek. And so what happened is as the church continued to grow in the West, it just was like, Latin continued to be the language. And then you would have a breakup, like all of a sudden in different areas of Europe, Western Europe and England, things like that, different languages are developing. But it was very common. It's happened in the East as well of like, okay, there's a liturgical language and then there's the common language. And so the liturgical language in the East was Greek or maybe Church Slavonic. Like, for example, a lot of Greek Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox churches, they are not in a modern language. They're in like Church Slavonic or something like that.
Yeah.
This idea became very common among Christians that like, oh, there's this language. It allows us like psychologically, if nothing else, to realize how sacred this is, because you and I talking here, I mean, there's a certain sacredness to it because we're talking about our Lord and things like that. So I'm not trying to act like it's not, but like, as soon as you go into a service that's in Latin, you're like, oh, I need to kind of sit up a little straighter. Maybe I need to recognize this is something. Cause like, in a sense, the priest is talking to God, not you. And so like, and God can understand Latin even if you can't. And so there's this idea of like the sacredness of the importance of we're on holy ground right here when we come into church. Obviously, when you leave, you're still, all the things that are true about you're still following Christ, being a disciple, all that. But there is a place for this. Like, Moses at the burning bush, there is a place for certain times and places that are more sacred. And so that's kind of the Latin is just part of that. Now, I want to make it clear that in the Catholic Church today, the vast majority of churches are in the vernacular, in English or whatever. But this was like certain parishes maintain this with this belief that like, oh, we really think this, And I feel it. I feel it like when I walk in, because of the architecture, because of the smell with the incense, you know, it's kind of baked into our church is about 175 years old. And so the physical building, it smells like incense when you walk in.
Sure.
And then the Latin and the chant, and we have this beautiful music that's a Gregorian chant and things like that. I personally feel a little bit like, okay, I'm leaving earth for a moment. I'm entering into the heavenly liturgy. I'm becoming part of the liturgy that we all will be part of, that it talks about in Revelation, in heaven,
yeah.
At least we all hope to be part of. And so like, you know, that I feel like that. And so I escape from the worldly cares. Trust me, I get distracted as much as the next guy. But the point is that like,
I get it.
It keeps bringing me back to, okay, this is different. This is sacred. And so it helps me focus on, okay, I'm here to worship God. And so I think that's kind of the, and that over time just happened. And so like, I mean, the Latin was basically fixed in the liturgy by about the 3rd or 4th century in the West. Time of St. Gregory the Great, 600 AD, is when it became fully fixed. And really, it has the liturgy itself hasn't really changed substantially at all since about the 7th century. So.
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense. And again, you also get some of the, again, because of the politics between the Eastern and the Western churches, like I'm sure like the language as well, like that probably plays a role as well. I do just think like it is one of these things where, again, it's like, and this has been true of a lot of the things that I've observed. I mean, I've observed within like the higher liturgy churches is like, there is so much thought that goes into why they do what they do. The thing that it's easy to neglect is communicating the why, and rather than just leaving it at the level of this is just what we do. And I think like that education process is probably also contributing to like some of the walking away, you know, as well. It's like if there's all of this, especially when you're, you know, adding the extra element of it, this being all done in a different language on top of the, you know, the, yeah, seemingly like strange things that, again, even our church would do, things that would look strange to the average American who just steps in there. I think that, you know, if you're not doing a good job of explaining, you know, the why, like we didn't always do it this way. We've done this thing before, and then here's some other things. I think like explaining the why, we're in this moment where nobody knows why anything, that no, like we are on like an existential crisis, like an ontological crisis of like, what does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to be a woman? What is marriage? What is government? What is money? Like all of these are very live issues, and just, it's not going to cut it anymore. Right. To just not explain the why of a lot of these things. And so I think
you're absolutely right. And I think like, I have a love-hate relationship with the internet. I admit it, because like I've lived on it for so long. I mean, I've worked on it. I've got so much. I mean, my whole job is on it now. But of course, I hate it too, because we know all the dangers of the internet. But I really believe one of the most beautiful things about the internet is how much it's allowed us to educate and bring people to knowledge of Christ and knowledge of the church and things like that. Like one of the most popular videos I ever did, I was on somebody else's video, a guy named Taylor Marshall, and we literally did a step-by-step walk through the Latin Mass. And it's got hundreds of thousands of views. And people to this day, we did it 6 years ago, I think. People to this day still come up to me and say they saw that, because really what we did, I think it was like a 2-hour podcast. And we literally just walked through, okay, you walk in a Latin Mass, what do you do? Okay, the priest comes out, he does this. What does that mean? And we just go step by step through it. And there was a real hunger, because people are like, okay. And so people can share that now. I know a woman, we have a religious order of nuns that's connected to our parish. And there's these traditional nuns. And one of them, during COVID, she wasn't really, her family wasn't believers or anything. And she just went online and she ended up becoming Catholic through it. Robert Barron is a popular bishop in our church. And she watched some of that and she became, now she's a religious nun. And so it's like, I think there's a lot of ability now that we really can explain the why. There's really no excuse, in other words, not to explain the why. We know sometimes people will walk into our parish and it's just like, it's like an alien experience, and we know that. And so we try to be very much try to help them out and things like that. But honestly, a lot of them, they come to us because what happened was they watched a video or something online and they're like, hey, this sounds interesting. They go, they want to experience it. And so they're very open to it already. They're already kind of primed to say, okay, I understand it's going to be very different. And I want to take it back also to something we were talking about earlier about like people leaving the church and things like that. I'm convinced that the church needs the zag when everybody else is zigging. Like when everybody, the culture's going this way and trying to be more and more like it is just dumb. It's not faithful to Christ, which is the most important thing.
Yeah.
But really, I like the fact that like the traditional Lent mass that I go, we're leaning into the fact that we are different. Yeah, when you come here, it's going to be a challenge. We know that. You're not going to understand what's going on. In fact, we always tell people when you first start coming for the first few weeks, don't even try to follow along. You're just kind of soak it in. Then maybe you can pick up the missal and start saying, oh, what do these prayers actually mean in English? You know, what are they saying? And then you can learn more and more. And over time, you'll eventually, hopefully learn to love it. But we don't shy away from that barrier to entry, so to speak, because we think what it does is it reminds people that the surrounding culture is awful. It's anti-Christian. It's anti-human. And so going against that grain, it's the same challenge we have with Bitcoin, trying to explain people. Like you have this high hurdle to explain Bitcoin to somebody because they start off with just this idea of like money. They think their money is at the bank. I mean, if, for example, they think there's literally dollar bills sitting in a bank vault somewhere with their name attached to it. And it's like all of a sudden you got this huge high barrier of trying to get them to embrace Bitcoin. I feel the same way when I'm trying to explain the Latin Mass to people. It's like who know nothing about it. It's like, okay, I know I got to start at the beginning and kind of work my way up.
Definitely. Yeah. And that's, I mean, one of the things I talk to when I talk to people about Bitcoin, the verse that comes to mind is where Jesus says, those who are well have no need of a physician. It's those who are sick. And so there's so many people who in the United States, they don't feel the visceral need to look for something, an alternative to their national currency, local currency, whatever it is. But there's millions and hundreds of millions of people around the world who definitely are in that situation. And so some of it is just helping people to look at and recognize, you know, the shortfalls and the weaknesses of fiat currency relative to the history of, you know, basically historically, and then just even in relation to the last 50 years, a lot of the differences that have taken place. I had one more question and now it's escaping me. I'm trying to think. It's going to come to me in just a minute. I guess I'll give you we've been going for like an hour and 15 minutes. I'll give you kind of the last word. Is there anything else? I mean, where can people find more of your work? Where can they get the book? Is there, obviously it's on Amazon, but is there a place where you'll get more of the money?
Well, okay. If you go to ericsamus.com, my website, you can buy it directly from there. And I will not only get more of the money, you can buy it in Bitcoin there. So you can pay me in Bitcoin at there, but you can also do fiat if you want to. I understand not everybody can. So you can buy it there and Amazon. Amazon's fine too, but like I do get more of the money, and I will sign it if you buy it directly from me. If you pay in Bitcoin, you get 10% off at my website too. So I try to encourage you at Bitcoiners because the funny thing is like I've had the ability to buy with Bitcoin at my website for years and nobody ever used it because it was just a Catholic book. So I sell this book and now I'm getting the Bitcoin orders. Everybody's taking advantage of that 10%. So I'm like, there we go. Now we're talking. I get so excited too when I get a Bitcoin order. I admit it. I get a little email when an order comes in. And I honestly, the first thing I do now is I look to see if they pay with credit card or Bitcoin. And I just get more excited when it's in Bitcoin because I'm just like, oh, yes.
So here's a question. What's your payment process?
I knew you were going to ask me. It goes straight to my hard wallet, actually. Is that called? Oh, I switched over about a year ago and they have it set up. I think I'm going to reach the limit of free. Like right now it's free because I don't have that many transactions, but I'm starting to get more and more. I can't remember the name of it though, because I used Coinbase for a while and I would accept the altcoins and stuff like that years ago, and I never got any orders. I can't remember the name of it. So if you go to ericsamus.com, you'll also find my other links to my other books and other stuff. And crisismagazine.com is what I run. And so most of my writings are found there. Like I said, it's a conservative Catholic site. A lot of things that we would have shared with, non-Catholic Christians as well. But, you know, obviously some very Catholic stuff as well. I just did a podcast this week on will non-Catholics, you know, be saved? And because it's, you know, exactly. Mm. So we have all that, you know, we address all the issues and the controversial stuff. We don't shy away from it. So that's good.
Love it, man. Eric, thank you so much. And again, hopefully this won't be the last time. These writers of books tend to keep writing books. So maybe we'll have you back and can chat about future stuff in the future. And I'll be sure to keep my list of Catholic questions.
Yes. And shoot them to me anytime. Exactly. I'm happy to join you.
That'd be great. I was just thinking, I'm going to shoot you. Have you reached out to Pierre Rochard?
He actually endorsed my book. Yeah.
Oh, love. Yeah. Awesome. Okay, Pierre's a friend.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'm trying to figure out who other Bitcoin.
Yes, we have definitely been in contact. He endorsed the book. Bitstein, you know, Michael Goldstein, he endorsed the book. Yeah. I don't know if you know, but he recently became Catholic, actually. Yeah.
I did.
So great guys. Just great guys.
Giacomo Zucco is another one.
Okay. I don't think I knew that.
Yep. So he's from Italy. Okay. So I would love to connect you and do all I can to help you get on some other podcasts. But all right, Eric. And then for the rest of the audience, go get Eric's book, Pay in Bitcoin, ericsammons.com. And on top of that, just as a final reminder, we have 12 days left on the Kickstarter and Geyser campaign for our kids book, our Bitcoin kids book called The Orange Umbrella. It basically gives like a high level overview of an introduction to Bitcoin. We don't use the B word a single time in the book. You can find more information at tou.tgfb.com. That'll just redirect you to the Kickstarter. You can also look on geyser.fund if you want to fund it in Bitcoin. We'd really appreciate it. We are like just, I think, 82% funded. We're super close, and we'd love your help in getting over the line to get this thing printed. So again, thank you for listening to this episode of Thank God for Bitcoin podcast, and we'll be back next week. Actually, we'll be back tomorrow with another episode of To the Unknown Pod with our Presby friends, and we'll be talking about a bunch of different things. So grateful for you all, and we'll talk to you again soon.